You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest reports that America doesn't have enough forensic pathologists, and that's creating a backlog of much-needed autopsies. We'll find out why the shortage is posing problems for public health and safety. Right now, we check in with reporters around the state in our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. First, a boat manufacturer based in Superior has been awarded a 5-year contract to build patrol boats for the U.S. Navy. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Happy Friday.
To you, too. Now, tell us a little bit about the company Lake Assault Boats.
Yeah, Lake Assault Boats was founded in 2003. They were originally Lake Assault Custom Boats, and they built boats in Elk River, Minnesota, but later they became part of Fraser Shipyards, which has been building ships in Superior for more than 100 years. And so Lake Assault has historically built fire rescue boats, and they have since transitioned into, in addition to building the rescue boats, building boats for military and law enforcement in the last 5 years or so.
What are they going to be building for the Navy now under this contract?
So under this contract, they'd be building up to 119 force protection medium boats. Basically, they're patrol and security boats that provide anti-terrorism and protection patrols at U.S. Navy installations.
What are you hearing about public officials about the deal and the impact it could have on the local economy?
Local officials, including state lawmakers and area chamber officials, are saying this is a big win for the community. You know, not only is there going to be this infusion of federal money in the area, but it's also going to allow them to add jobs to be able to build these boats.
And talk about the kind of money and numbers of jobs. Are people putting out job numbers attached to this yet?
Yeah, so this would be an up to $56 million contract if they build all 119 boats. And so that would allow the company to add 20 to 25 jobs. They currently have about 45 employees.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about Lake Assault Boats getting a 5-year contract to build patrol boats for the U.S. Navy. Now, Okano County in northeastern Wisconsin is investing in 2 pieces of property along the Okano River, giving anglers more access to prime trout fishing waters. Kent Tempest is a reporter for the Okano County Reporter, part of the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Kent, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Rob. Glad to be here.
Tell us about these 2 pieces of fishing accessible land.
One is about 30 acres northeast of Suring, and it's got about 1,000 feet of footage along both sides of the south branch of the Okano River. The second one is just only about a half acre, and it's got about 100 feet of footage along the north branch of the Okano River, and that's northeast of Mountain.
Can you talk about the different funding sources that are going into making this possible?
Sure. The smaller property is being donated by the owners of the 30-acre site. They asked the county a couple years ago if it was interested in buying the property, and that gave the county officials time to apply for and get a $55,000 grant called the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Grant from the Wisconsin DNR, and that covered about half the cost. The rest is being split about equally between the county and 6 sportsmen's groups, including several chapters of Trout Unlimited.
And it sounds like this is prime fishing real estate?
Oh, yes. That's why the sportsmen's groups were so eager to contribute. Much of the south branch of the river is considered a trophies waters area with special regulations because the fishing is so good. That's according to the chairman of the county's Forestry and Parks Committee. And I'm also told the North Branch is also an excellent fishing spot.
What kind of timeline is there for having this open to the fishing public?
The county's Forestry and Parks Director told me he'd be working on finalizing the property transfers next week and is hoping to get it all wrapped up in time so the public can use the sites by the fishing opener in May. Anglers, though, who want to try and get to the sites are going to have to make sure they are ready to traverse some woods to get to the rivers, though. They're going to have to walk a ways.
Kent, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
Kent Tempest is a reporter for the Okano County Reporter, with us to talk about the county investing in 2 pieces of property along the Okano River that will most likely be open to the public for fishing this spring. Now, nurses at UW Hospital in Madison said in December they plan to revive their union, which had been dissolved in the wake of 2011's Act 10 legislation. Yesterday, they took their concerns to the board of the UW Hospital and Clinics Authority. Shemaine Mills is a WPR reporter who is at that meeting. Shemaine, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Remind us why the union went away and now why the nurses are trying to bring it back.
Well, we haven't heard about unions in roughly 10 years when steps were taken to dismantle them. Now we're hearing about one again, an attempt to revive a union. Nurses say that working conditions are so bad that they need the protections of a union.
And the talk here isn't about a pay raise, because as I understand, Act 10 still, you can't, that's not really what you can collectively bargain for as public employees now. Talk a little more about what they are hoping to get out of a union.
Right. Pay isn't so much an issue because there's a nursing shortage. So the hospital is forced to pay what's necessary to get people in the door and have their staffing levels up. What nurses are concerned about is the fact they have to care for so many patients. They contend that they're caring for as many as 8 patients, which is twice as many as they should be.
They took this, as we mentioned, to the UW Hospital and Clinics board last night. You were there. What was the response from the board?
Well, they were given 15 minutes to speak, and they outlined their concerns, and then the board went into closed session for several hours. But as they've said before, they said again, no, not going to recognize the union, voluntary or otherwise. They did make an effort, though, to offer some sort of concession, saying, we do want to remedy these concerns of yours. We want to meet with you and try to rectify the situation, which the nurses said, no, we want a seat at the table. We want a union.
And as I understand it, the board said under Act 10, we legally can't recognize the union. And it sounds like the organizers and people backing them didn't buy that legal argument.
No, they said, our lawyers have told us that law does not stand in the way of you voluntarily recognizing the union. However, the board for the hospital says otherwise. So they're at legal odds. It's kind of a gray area, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, right. I'm assuming that the nurses trying to organize this, this isn't the end of the story for them?
No. In fact, they said, we are not going to stop. We want a union. We will be back. So expect to see them trying to drum up public support in the form of resolutions like the Dane County Board recognized them and said they support them. And also, they'll probably be at next month's hospital board meeting.
Shemaine, thanks for bringing us up to date.
You bet.
Shemaine Mills is a WPR reporter covering health issues. She talked with us about the ongoing effort of nurses at UW Hospital to revive their union and have it recognized. And she closed out our Wisconsin News Roundup. Coming up, we'll look at America's shortage of medical examiners and what it means for public health and safety. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's a lot of focus on getting a college education to boost job prospects, but what about the many people in Wisconsin with a high school degree, maybe some college, but no diploma? We'll find out what the economy holds for them and what kind of policies might help them out. First, when somebody appears to have died of unnatural causes, a forensic pathologist would normally perform an autopsy. But there's a problem. There aren't that many people doing that work. In fact, about a decade ago, the National Research Council said there were fewer than 500 of them in the U.S. By comparison, there are more than 12,000 dermatologists. Since then, the opioid epidemic has made for drastically more work, and medical examiners are having a hard time keeping up. Some offices wind up falling so far behind they have to ship bodies to other offices, and then those offices become overloaded. As a result, some medical examiners have to pick and choose which bodies to autopsy. That could have serious consequences to public health and safety. Jordan Kisner is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, and other publications. Her recent piece in the New York Times Magazine is titled Piled Bodies, Overflowing Morgues, Inside America's Autopsy Crisis. It's adapted from her new book called Thin Places, Essays from In Between, which comes out next week. Jordan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, glad to be with you.
You write that our death investigation system in the United States is under threat of collapsing. How bad is it?
You know, if you take seriously the claims of the many forensic pathologists and coroners and medical examiners that I spoke to for this essay, it's pretty dire. I was speaking recently with Dr. Tom Gilson, who's the Cuyahoga County medical examiner, chief medical examiner, and he was making the point that there are so few people to do such a large amount of work. And what's more, this population of forensic pathologists are starting to age out. Many more who are getting to the retirement age than there are young forensic pathologists coming into the field. So it's looking to get worse yet before it gets better.
You write that a lot of the forensic pathologists themselves feel that they're kind of an overlooked specialty, that people think doctors should be, what they do is heal the living. So we kind of overlook the ones who work with dead people. But talk about the value of the work they do as kind of an early warning system for big health problems in the United States.
They're a really crucial part of national and local public health. When somebody dies in a way that is unnatural, so that could be homicide, that could be an accidental poisoning, that could be in a motor vehicle accident, it could be a drowning. Anytime a death like that occurs, that person is or should be sent for examination and possibly autopsy to their local coroner or medical examiner. And what those people then have the ability to do is to start identifying patterns. It was forensic pathologists and the forensic toxicologists they work with that first noticed that there was an uptick in heroin overdoses and then a rise of new opioids entering the United States. So they are often the first line of defense to spot patterns, rising tides of trends of things that are dangerous to us, that are killing us.
Now, digging more into how this all works, we might hear medical examiner and we might hear coroner, and they might be synonyms in our mind. They are not. Can you talk about the difference between those jobs and what they do?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So it's a little bit of a square and a rectangle situation. So there is a person who is a forensic toxicologist. This is somebody who's gone through medical school, done a pathology. I'm talking about forensic pathologists. Mm-hmm. I said toxicologist. A forensic pathologist is the person who is empowered to perform an autopsy on behalf of the state. And they have gone to medical school. They've done their extra pathology residency, and then they've done further training in forensics. These people can go on to be medical examiners, and medical examiners have to be forensic pathologists, or it's possible that they could go on to be coroners. Coroners have more loose regulations in their qualifications. So in many places, a coroner could just be somebody who's lived there for more than a year, is of legal age, and has no, crime convictions locally. So you could be not even a doctor and be a coroner.
Be a coroner in some places.
You or I could be a coroner in some places. But to be a medical examiner, you must be a forensic pathologist, which is to say a medical doctor with extra specialty training. So when we talk about coroners versus medical examiners, these are both positions that are the job in their local jurisdiction, in their county or their state, whose job it is to determine cause of death for the official public record and to sign the death certificate. The question is, which of these people are forensic pathologists? And if a coroner is not a forensic pathologist, they have to outsource any autopsy labor to the nearest forensic pathologist.
So we don't have enough forensic pathologists, as you report. Why? What are the reasons that we don't have a new generation of people picking this as their medical specialty?
There are a number of reasons that I was given. The first is that because forensic pathologists who go to work in either coroner's office or with medical examiners, they are public employees. They are government employees. They work for the county or the state where they live. And because they're government employees, their salaries come out of local budget, which means that they are often much less well paid than other medical specialties. They'll make much less money going into forensic pathology than they would if they, for example, went into orthopedic surgery. And that is just because of how their salary is paid and what budget it comes out of. So that's one big problem. The second is that because there are too few forensic pathologists, it is often a career path that involves a lot of overwork, a heavy workload, long days. It's a stressful position, as any job is when there are not enough of you and not enough money to go around. And the third that I spoke to pathologists about is a little bit of an unspoken bias in certain institutions against work that deals with the dead. So for example, in medical school, a lot of the time around the second, third, and fourth year, medical students are being introduced to different field specialties they could go into. They can maybe do a rotation in a surgical ward. They can do a rotation in pediatrics. And it's very rare, actually, that medical schools offer information about, much less a rotation in, forensic pathology. So even at the point when young doctors-to-be are considering their career paths, they're often not presented with forensic pathology even as an option.
Talking to Jordan Kisner about her piece, Piled Bodies, Overflowing Morgues Inside America's Autopsy Crisis. It's in the New York Times Magazine, adopted from her book out next week called Thin Places. Jordan, you spent time, especially in the Cuyahoga County, that's where I think Cleveland, Ohio is working, or not working with, but watching along as the medical examiners work there. Can you give us a sense of what it's like to be there and do that job?
You know, something that I was expecting and that I think many people expect when they think of what it might be like to be with medical examiners who are doing autopsies and doing work in morgues is that you sort of expect that it might feel really grim, that it might happen underground in some sort of dark, dank room. And I was, and that everybody there might seem sort of like, you know, broody. And I was really pleasantly surprised to see that in that county, the building is full of light. It's very airy. The people who work there are energized and passionate, and they speak very thoughtfully and beautifully and compassionately about the work that they do. And the work that they do is hard to watch. An autopsy, no matter how bright and sunshiny the room is, can be hard for an outside viewer to watch. And so I did find it very arresting to observe them as they worked. But I really came away thinking of it as an honor to watch them, because they are extremely dedicated public servants and extremely skilled medical doctors who spend their entire lives devoted to this service when they could be making a lot more money and probably have a little bit, you know, a little bit of an easier work life doing something else.
Now, we are, of course, watching for a potential outbreak of this novel coronavirus here in the United States. What kind of role might medical examiners play in watching for new fatalities from an emerging disease like that?
You know, interestingly, historically, medical examiners have played a role in identifying new viruses or new strains of a known virus. What I'm a little bit unsure of right now, and I haven't reported this out, is whether a coronavirus death, a coronavirus mortality, would be deemed in all cases an unnatural death. So often, if a person has received an illness diagnosis before they've died, and then they die, an autopsy isn't necessary because it is already medically understood why they died. In the case of many deaths from coronavirus, that may be how it goes. So I'm not sure under what circumstances. I'm not sure if there are going to be a new sort of wave of autopsies that need to be undertaken because of coronavirus. But I think that it's likely that that will be a jurisdiction by jurisdiction call. And in general, I think that this epidemic gives us a really sobering look at the importance of having medical systems and public health systems be well-staffed, well-trained, well-funded, in good working condition, ready with, you know, a little extra room and energy to take on big systemic challenges like this. Because when they are already stressed and not quite prepared, a lot of lives are at stake.
With this shortage of medical examiners in your reporting, did you see efforts out there to try to get more of them?
Yeah. So a lot of the people that I spoke to, and I spoke to coroners and medical examiners in several different states, And they all talked about the importance of bringing in the community to see what they do. So there's a lot of outreach efforts that often happen locally to involve, you know, to do tours for and sometimes demonstration autopsies for local medical school students, local college students, sometimes even local high school students. It is important for them to be bringing in the public as much as they are able, given their, you know, time and resources, just to spread awareness of what this job is. A lot of Americans, and before I really was working on this story, I was one of them, doesn't really know what the system is, barely thinks about whether or not it exists. It's by definition a system that you are usually not in a position to report back when you see it up close. And so just creating education and awareness of this field, of its importance, is, I think, a big focus right now.
As we wrap up, Jordan, do you think, as you talk to these people, overwhelmed in many cases by overwork, do most of them seem to be sticking with it as long as they can?
You know, I think it depends. One thing that you've seen in the last several years is there's a wave of either resignations in protest or slightly early retirement, because it is a number of chief medical examiners have retired. So, for example, in the chief medical examiner of New Jersey, of Los Angeles County, of Cook County, Illinois, which serves Chicago, have resigned in protest because their caseloads are too high and they cite insufficient funding and resources. The Baltimore chief medical examiner recently retired early, citing the same problems. So you do see people being pushed out perhaps before the end of their natural career, just out of sheer exhaustion.
Jordan, thanks a lot for sharing this story with us today.
Thank you.
That's Jordan Kistner, a freelance writer whose works appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, and elsewhere. Her piece in the New York Times Magazine that we've been talking about on America's shortage of medical examiners is titled Piled Bodies, Overflowing Morgues Inside America's Autopsy Crisis. That's adapted from her new book. It's called Thin Places, Essays from In Between. That is out next week. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the economic prospects for workers with a high school education and or a little bit of college education, but no degree. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent welcomes a Republican state lawmaker for a look at water quality laws, assistance to farmers, and arguments over what to do with a state budget surplus. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for many people growing up today, there's often an expectation that they'll go to college. The biggest share of the American workforce last year was of workers with a bachelor's degree or higher, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. And a lot of policy arguments in the Democratic presidential race center around college education funding. But what about workers with a high school education? Where do they fit into the economy? And there's another group of workers that don't often get a lot of attention, workers with some college and no degree. Last year, almost 22 million Americans fell into that category, accounting for about 15% of the workforce in 2019. Steve Deller is a professor at UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. He's also a community development specialist in the Center for Community and Economic Development. Steve, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
Well, looking at charts for your organization that we've talked about before, it seems like, on average, the more education you have, the better salary you're going to make in the long term. Individual mileage may vary, but that's the general trend, right?
It is true. I mean, the wage difference, in Wisconsin, if you don't have a high school diploma, your average or median weekly wage is just under $500. But if you've got a master's degree, it's up to $1,300 a week. So there's there's almost a three times, four times difference in terms of what your weekly, say, wages can be.
But from a policy standpoint, the solution, I think, and I don't think anybody's proposing this, the solution is not for everybody to end up with a bachelor's degree or higher, right?
No, because when you look at kind of what are the jobs that are being generated out there, the Department of Workforce Development every 4 or 5 years do these large occupational forecasts on what do we think the industries are going to be growing and then what occupations are tied to those industries. And some of the fastest growing sectors, occupations in the state of Wisconsin require no formal education whatsoever. For example, the fastest growing one is personal care aides. Okay, and there's no formal education required for that. And the problem, though, is that it doesn't pay very much. I mean, you're looking at a median wage annual salary of about $22,000. We're generating a lot of those kind of jobs.
Right. You've talked in the past on the show about a lot of jobs at the low end of the pay scale.
Yes.
Some pretty good growth at the higher ends of the pay scale and a little hollowing out in the middle.
Exactly.
Now, let's look at this this category that doesn't get a lot of attention. We hear about high school education, bachelor's degree, but there's a pretty good number of people out there, a high school education and plus some college. That can cover a lot of ground, though, it seems like.
That can. It really can. And a lot of the jobs that are growing, for example, if you want to be a truck driver, right, you need a high school degree plus some professional training. So, you know, it's not so much that, you know, I enrolled in college and I quit after my freshman year, or I took a couple of classes at the technical college and I stopped. A lot of the jobs really are kind of you need that little additional type of training, perhaps for a license or because of the very specific nature of the job, like a truck driver. You do see this in some of the trades, carpenters, electricians. There's no formal education requirement, but you need that additional training so that you can be a plumber or be an electrician.
Is there enough focus on that? We talk about the loss of the manufacturing job that that person with just the high school degree could have. That's declined a lot over the years. We focus a lot on, you know, college tuition and the student loan debt. Do we focus enough on the people who need a little something past high school but not necessarily a full-on four-year degree?
I think we do. It kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And I think part of what gets lost in the shuffle is almost at the high school level. And it's because we the way that we've been kind of spending our tax monies on local education, K-12 education at the high school level, it's cheaper, to be honest with you, to run a lot of advanced placement English or advanced placement math or things like that. So it's cheaper to kind of structure high school to get you into college. And what we're missing is a lot of those good old-fashioned shop classes that kind of expose kids to saying, hey, you know, with a little additional training, I could become a mechanic and make a pretty good living at it.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison about what the economy looks like for people with a high school degree, with a high school plus some kind of technical training or an associate's degree or some college. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you fit into one of those very broad categories, love to hear about you, your experience with getting jobs, the kind of pay you can get, the twists and turns of your career, wherever you are on that stage. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, you mentioned, people with some kind of technical education, maybe an associate's degree, but that is part of this category. We look at statistics, the person who maybe started off toward a bachelor's, didn't make it all the way. They have some of the debt that goes along with it, but not the degree that's going to get them better pay down the road. That's a whole nother story.
That's a different story. There's a difference between saying, I see an opportunity, I want to be a carpenter, okay? And I take some classes at the local technical college, and I take a handful of classes to get some skills in carpentry, and I land a job, and I'm making pretty good money. I don't finish the degree, but I'm still making good money. Those types of situations oftentimes get lost in the statistics. So when we look at these averages, I mean, that's fundamentally different than somebody who said, okay, I'm going to take classes at the technical college because I don't want to get a job yet, and da, 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 and they kind of just fall by the wayside. There's a difference between those types of workers.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Thomas is with us in Ripon. Thomas, hi.
Hi. I was just listening to that, and it was kind of interesting. You're talking about a master's degree making $1,300 a week, and I have a bachelor's.
Oop, are you still there, Thomas?
Experience.
There you go.
I am here. It's bachelor's degree in IT, 25 years experience. And my wife became disabled, so I'm the only earner. And I tell you, $40,000 a year just wasn't cutting it. So I got a job where I got trained to become a truck driver and make $20,000 more a year driving a truck. And I'll tell you, this is the easiest job I've ever had in my life.
Thomas, thanks a lot. So his truck driving career making more than a bachelor's in IT, which I think of being as a job that you can make some money in.
There's a couple of things. One is I think a lot of these trade jobs, you can make some really good money in the trades. I used to swing a hammer for my brother-in-law, and the plumber was always driving a brand new top of the line pickup truck. You can make some really good money, and you don't necessarily need a formal degree in order to do that type of work. Trucking, for example, you got to get a license, and you have to do certain training so that you can get that license. But if you are willing to work hard, you can make a pretty good living at that type of stuff. A lot of the jobs, though, you have to realize that there's a lot of kind of where are the jobs located at. There's a classic story of Oklahoma where they had a shortage of nurses, nursing aides in particular. So the state put a lot of money into the technical schools to get people trained up to be nursing aides. And the problem, though, is that a lot of the money was being spent in these kind of remote rural areas where there was a light, surplus labor, but the shortage was really in the two big cities in Oklahoma. So I go to school, I get this associate's degree in nursing, I got to pick up and move. And a lot of folks won't do that. They can't do that, or they won't do that.
Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, looking at job prospects for people with a high school degree or high school plus some college or technical training. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Let us know how your career went, is going, or you hope it goes, depending on where you are in the process. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, hear from more of you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steve Deller from UW-Madison about the high school plus sector of the American economy, people with a high school degree and some college, an associate's degree, some kind of technical training, and where they fit into the economy, what job prospects are out there for them. For you, if that's you, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go back to our callers. Max is with us in Green Bay. Max, hi.
Hi. My buddy and I at the shop, we're both mechanics, and we actually fit basically exactly what you're describing. We both have some technical, we both went to technical schools, and but we learned a lot of what we know now on the job. You know, if you get in with a decent shop or something like that, you can learn the ropes really quick.
Max, and, was the technical school part of it worth it, though, to get that to get into that first job?
Yes, it was very helpful. Actually, even before I was done with my 2-year degree, I did have a job at a car lot, and you learn a lot of the fundamentals in school. But then, working in the field, you pick up how to do stuff quicker and easier. And then going into the second year of school, you get into the more like engines and transmissions and stuff like that. And I think both of them helped greatly furthering my career.
Max, thanks a lot for that call. School plus the hands-on, kind of a hybrid there.
That's invaluable. There's two kind of bosses out there, one that views their employees as their most valuable asset and those that think that they're a necessary evil. If you can get that first kind, they can be a godsend. They're the kind of boss that you want to continue to work for, and they will invest in you. And it sounds as though you're in that kind of a situation. Hats off to you. Very good.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Jim on the road between Madison and UW-Stout. Jim, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I was I'm just returning from a Skills USA event at UW-Stout today, and I thought this was really appropriate. Most importantly, that if you're in the going into the skilled trades, and that covers a lot of different ground, includes automotive, the built environment, engineering, all sorts of stuff like that, that if you're in high school or if you're in a technical school or, for that matter, a UW school, it's a really good idea to get involved in the CTSO. That's a career technical student organization, for which this event that I was at today is probably the fastest growing one in the country. That's called Skills USA. And those folks take high school students that may or may not, really have direction where they want to go. And by the time that school is done, they are shot out like a cannon, like an arrow, and they got real direction. And that's a really big deal because we need build trades people getting into the space. There's great money in it, but there's too few schools out there that various school boards. It's a really wild landscape.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Is this stuff that's just maybe off the radar for a lot of students, where if you do a program like this, it's going to help lure them in, Steve?
It's a lot of students, particularly coming out of high school, they need a lot of mentoring. They don't know what they don't know. And when we had, kind of the resources to have a shop class, to have a woodworking shop, to have a mechanic shop, and have those kind of classes in high school, students were exposed to that. And they kind of saw a career opportunity for them through that. We're losing those in a lot of schools, particularly the more rural schools. And so there's a disconnect. There's basically, the environment that they're in is basically, if you're not going on to college, then there's nothing for you. And that's doing us a disservice.
Thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Nancy is with us in Grafton. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Here in Grafton, Carl Hader is our automotive teacher here in Grafton High School. He's the top in the country as an automotive teacher. Excellent man. And, another thing we could have is culinary arts or something in high schools, because for men and women, because most of your good chefs are men. And when I was a kid, I wanted to be in agriculture. I was a freshman, and by gosh, they had agriculture classes. And I was a farm girl, and I wanted to be in agriculture.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call, that role of maybe that one, in this case, auto teacher, Nancy says, in Grafton.
It can really make a long time, lifelong impression. And I think this is where we're getting a bit of a disconnect, because if you look in like Madison, the Madison schools, the Madison high schools, they have state-of-the-art shops and things like that. But you get out of some of these more rural school districts or some of the school districts that are not quite as wealthy as Madison, and, they're cutting corners everywhere they can. And a lot of these shop classes are extremely expensive to run and operate. So it's, I think the short-term budget decisions are affecting us long-term.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. In our last minute or two, Steve, I want to talk about entrepreneurship. I know from your research, sometimes that bachelor's degree is a sweet spot for getting people to create businesses. Can we get people, high school education, high school plus, in entrepreneurship too?
I think it's extremely important. We'd like to say that, when you do the statistics, having a bachelor's degree does kind of help with the entrepreneurship, but I think there might be some what we call sample selection bias. People that are likely to start a business will likely go and get a bachelor's degree, so what's driving what? But you don't need a college degree to start a business. My sister, for example, she barely made it out of high school, but she runs her own business, and she is extremely successful. So, having a college degree helps, but it's not necessary. What is necessary is finding something that you're good at, something that you're passionate about, and focusing your career on that. Now, that may mean you have to pick up and move a little bit. It may be that those opportunities are not where you're currently living, and you may have to relocate a little bit. That sometimes can be a problem.
Can we just very briefly, do we need efforts like the shop class, like the Skills Plus, to encourage entrepreneurship maybe in our high schools?
I think we do. I think that, introducing entrepreneurship, small business development, what's it like to be your own business owner at the high school level, I think is something that we should be doing.
Steve, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thanks to our callers as well. That was Steve Deller of UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. He was with us today to talk about what we know about the economic prospects for workers with a high school diploma and maybe some kind of college or technical education, but no bachelor's degree. Wisconsin's Hmong community has responded forcefully to the Trump administration's moves to increase deportations to Laos. The administration is negotiating to deport potentially thousands of Hmong who broke the law here in the U.S., even if they've served their time. WPR's Rob Menser has more.
On a bright, bitter cold winter day, members of the Hmong community and their allies gathered outside the courthouse in Wausau, Wisconsin.
Policies that rip American communities and families apart have no part in the American lexicon.
Ka Lo is the first Hmong woman elected to the county board. Her parents came to the U.S. as refugees in the late 1970s. She says news that the Trump administration wants to ramp up deportations of Hmong has galvanized the community. She says leaders, including herself, are speaking out in ways they never have before.
I have a message for our Hmong leaders, and I'm going to say this in Hmong.
In an interview after the rally, Lo said some Hmong leaders have been hesitant to hold a rally in the Republican-leaning county that voted for Trump.
My message in Hmong that I said was that we have to come together to help each other because we're not going to get through this dividing each other.
The group had gathered in front of the Hmong Lao Veterans Memorial here. Hmong soldiers fought as allies of the United States in the Vietnam War. After the war ended, tens of thousands fled Laos and persecution from its communist government. Yang Sao Zhang is a professor of Asian American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
The Hmong community has for a very long time understood that they have this very unique relationship with the U.S., and that is their relationship as a former ally.
Hmong were generally protected from deportation in the past because the government of Laos wouldn't accept most deportees from the U.S. Now, the State Department has confirmed to NPR, the Trump administration is calling on Laos to accept more deportees and has offered funding for a reintegration program there. The administration has secured a similar agreement with Cambodia and has also increased deportations to Vietnam. Zhang says Hmong communities are feeling betrayed.
There are times when they are treated as citizens, and then there are times when they're treated as clearly outsiders. So this relationship fluctuates depending on this larger political context.
There are about 300,000 Hmong people in the U.S., and most are citizens. But some are not, and about 4,500 of these green card holders have deportation orders against them. That's because they've been convicted of a crime or found to have violated immigration laws. Advocates say these people could still face persecution in Laos, and very few of them have any connection to that country. Immigration data shows that most have been here for at least a decade, and many for more than 20 years.
Many of these individuals came into the United States as children.
Chai Mua works for Freedom, Inc., a Madison-based nonprofit that's helping those at risk of deportation to get legal protection. She recently met with a group of Hmong women who fled Laos years ago and whose children could now be deported.
These mothers are saying, these are the children that we had on our backs while we crossed the Mekong River. These are the children that we had risked our lives for to bring here to the United States.
The Wausau World Market is a Hmong-owned mall with shops selling bubble tea, fishing gear, and traditional Hmong dress.
As you can tell, there's multiple shops through here, and then they also do farmer's market.
Yiling Zhang is the director of Wausau's Hmong American Center. This central Wisconsin city of about 40,000 people has almost 5,000 Hmong residents, the highest concentration of anywhere in the U.S. Zhang says the negotiations with Laos have created panic in the community.
Because there's no information, it creates this fear that's still going on, this fear of the unknown.
Zhang and other leaders say they're trying to keep misinformation from spreading, and they're asking elected officials for help. Congresswoman Betty McCollum, a Minnesota Democrat, says she'll introduce legislation this week aimed at stopping Hmong deportations. For NPR News, I'm Rob Menser in Wausau, Wisconsin.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, many rural areas were hard hit by the Great Recession. We'll look at efforts to rebuild a business climate in rural America, find out some of the things that might have worked and where there is still a need for improvement in rural areas around the country. We'll get some of the latest news on the novel coronavirus story and the latest on efforts to help prevent its spread here in the United States and around the world, plus a look at some early missteps here in the U.S. when it came to testing for the novel coronavirus as we were watching for it to spread to the country. Plus, a guest makes the case that we need to do more to protect democracy from online attacks. A look at the digital world, foreign interference in U.S. elections, the authoritarian uses of the internet, and more. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.